get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today I've got something a little different for you. Usually we're focused on the digital marketing SEO side of building and developing your online business or your website. We touched a little bit on that in the beginning with Emma Powell. We talk about mainly something very interesting, which is how to identify your custom avatar or the person that you're trying to write to or market to on your website. She brings up some really good points and some tips for you that you can use on your about page instead of having the about page just about yourself. And it's about instead about how essentially you're helping them and the benefits there. But where this podcast really shines and where I really wanted to take this was actually in terms of diversification outside of your niche websites. Obviously, we're all involved in digital assets and having our footprint online in terms of what we have in terms of investments. But she's a real estate expert, and I wanted to bring someone on to talk about real estate and how you can get started in that and why you would want to, because obviously we know that having a website is a low cost to start it up. It's quite easy to scale. You can scale it to very, I guess, large sums of income each month, and then you can sell it for a lot of money at the end of it. But with real estate, obviously you've got a lot of capital taken up very quickly, and then your cash flow is much lower. However, Emma goes through a lot of different benefits from being in real estate, mainly in terms of tax benefits and the way you can actually really lower your tax bill, or in fact get essentially tax returns back at the end of the financial year. And we just cover different things to do with real estate, different, I guess, terminology as well, where to start, how you can get into it, how much money you need, and all of that. So if you've just recently sold a website or you're making a lot in terms of cash flow and you're looking to diversify outside the digital space, then this podcast will be perfect for you as you look maybe at another income stream, and that could be real estate. So enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show, and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have Emma Powell. Welcome, Emma.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is actually, I'm really looking forward to this one because it's kind of like marrying my old life with my new life.
Oh, perfect then. We can bridge it all together. So I guess we met in Austin 4 or 5 years ago now when you're working with the rugby team here. And I see you're wearing also the Austin rugby shirt, but too bad the team is kind of, even with new owners, is still shitting the bed now and having problems. So
yeah.
that's unfortunate.
That's business. You know, you're always dealing with some sort of an issue. So I was super excited for them this year. And we moved to Salt Lake. Austin and Salt Lake played a game recently, and it was great to see all of the athletes that I knew and the team members and all of that. And then the announcement came out. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. They're finally having a good year. And it's been tough.
They're having ownership and money problems now again. Yeah. So it's the typical, I guess, rugby world. It doesn't seem to change much anywhere you go.
Yeah.
But maybe do it. Oh, yeah, fair enough. Do you want to maybe give a brief background about yourself for anyone listening? And we'll dive into some of the topics we've got today. It's going to be a little different for the listeners. we're going to do a little bit of the digital, I guess, asset side, but we're going to look at it more in terms of diversifying into physical assets as well.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I think, like I said, this is fun to be using my skills from my previous life in order to build my new business and just kind of seeing where that crossover happens, which I think is kind of funny because in rugby, in American rugby, we talk about that a lot where we don't have a lot of rugby athletes, but we'll go and we'll look at other sports, basketball, wrestling, track, things like that. And then we just train in the rugby skills and they go off and they're off to the races. And so I think if we can kind of look at our businesses from that same mindset, like what do you already do? What are you already good at? And then what of those skills can you apply to the new venture? And so that's exactly what I had to do 4 years ago. My husband, we're living in Austin. I had a wedding and real estate photography business, and I was doing the content management for the rugby team there. And my husband was working in data science and IT, and he got laid off again because it's tech industry, right? And it was kind of funny because he had recruiters calling him and they were asking him what cities he would be interested in. I really wanted to stay in Austin. We had built a life there. We had a little ranch farm, you know, homestead there.
Oh, nice.
And we're going to raise the kids and, you know, had our acreage, our dream home, the whole thing. Right. And he mentioned, he said, well, my wife might be willing to move to Salt Lake City because they've got, the rugby league is headquartered there and they have a team. And so that would allow her to be able to get a job still in this kind of niche industry. And I said, sure, you know, why not? And the Salt Lake recruiters were just all over it. They set him up something like 6 interviews in 6 days. He had a job interview. We drove up here, a job interview every single day. He had a job offer the week we left. And he got nothing in Austin, not even a single interview. And he, it was just a really difficult position. So we sold that ranch that we had. And we made a bunch of money off of that because we basically had flipped this thing ourselves while we were living in it. And doing a lot of the work and learned a ton about construction and construction management because we did have to hire a lot of contractors as well for some of the heavy work that we couldn't do on our own. And then we sold that house and we moved up to Salt Lake City. It was probably 6 weeks from the day he lost his job to the day that we were driving the moving truck out of the driveway. I did remote for the team for a little while. But I gave up the photography business, obviously didn't want to regrow that because it was a lot of hustle and starting from scratch again for a job that I knew could really only gross me like 100, maybe 150K a year. That's gross. Yeah. And it just, you know, I was getting older, my hands were starting to hurt, the cameras are heavy. And so I was just really lost in trying to find myself and what I was going to do. And so I picked up another consulting gig doing marketing and content management for a data science company that my husband, when he was laid off, the founder of that company left and started his own company. So he didn't need an IT guy, but he needed a marketer. So I went off and started working for his old boss, doing like websites and social media and just any kind of visual assets that they needed for PowerPoint talks. And when we moved up to Salt Lake, he asked me if I would start organizing the Python Data Science Salt Lake City meetup. So I did that for about a year or so. And just really just trying to cobble together some freelance income and rebuild my life. And so I started going to a lot of business networking meetings and I thought I would do some sort of small business consulting. I had just finished my degree the summer before in 2017 in entrepreneurial management, which is basically like startups and venture funds and all of the management. We have to be an expert at lots of different things, project manager style. And I thought, okay, so we got all these small businesses, photographers, massage therapists, insurance sales guys at all these business networking meetings, and none of them knew how to run a business. And they were struggling how to do their books, how to do their social media. And I thought, I can just go in there and basically give them tasks. And then when they do their homework, I come back and we go to the next phase. That's how I love to do anything. And this is another one of those skills that I've been able to translate over to my real estate business when I finally landed there. It's like, I like to create plans and lists and create systems, but then I like to delegate the homework to the people who are the experts in those particular fields. And so that was what I was looking at doing. But one of these business networking meetings I went to was a real estate investing group. And I got home and I started researching this group to see if I wanted to join. It was kind of expensive. And I came across Bigger Pockets and I came across the National REIA Association. And so I signed up for Bigger Pockets. They have podcasts, they have videos, they have forums, lots of free education, low cost books, low cost courses, things like that. And in the real estate world, you'll go in and they'll charge you $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 for education. And I just felt like that was a total racket. That's like a college degree. And I felt like anything that I want to learn, I mean, I was self-taught in Photoshop. I was self-taught in photography. I went out and started a business. And that's not to say I'll never pay for a class or pay for education, but I certainly didn't want to start with some $10,000 or $20,000, because they try and make it look like a secret vault. And you have to pay all this money to get into here, and there's nowhere else to learn this. And Bigger Pockets really blew the lid off of that racket and put it out there, democratized real estate education. And so I just started going to our national, like our local chapter of the RIA, National RIA Association, and just networking and meeting people. And I thought, hey, I should just start investing in real estate, because I was a real estate photographer for 10 years and I've always loved the space and thought, I want to get into this. I just didn't know how. And when I had a source of information and I had a network of people who were doing it, suddenly the how was no longer the issue. After that, it was just getting it done, raising enough money, finding deals, and just getting down to the grind and getting it done. So that was basically where we started the move and kind of reinventing myself, and then realizing that real estate could give me not only a hedge against layoffs, because at first I was looking for a job, I was looking for an active investing. But when I got into it and started running properties and doing deals, I realized I could make enough money in this to retire my husband from his job. And that's when my focus really shifted to passive income, because I didn't want him to quit his job just so that I could be running a business and he'd be sitting around like, okay, now what am I going to do? So I really shifted hard, even just maybe 6 months into it. Like, I don't actually need to be an active investor. I just need to be a passive investor. And so I just kept doing the active stuff, because we were just trying to pile up enough cash that we could put it in other people's deals, let them manage it, and then we could retire. You have to have a certain amount of cash invested in order to get that regular income. So when I shifted gears to that, it was like game over. So we're working on retiring him and planning out what the next phase of our life is going to look like once he is able to quit his job.
So you basically clocked life then.
Yeah.
You're pretty much free to do whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. All right. So I want to jump back a little bit first and start with the digital marketing side that you're doing for some of these rugby teams and some of these other businesses. Now, I guess when we're talking like content marketing things, when we're talking like niche website builders, many people are looking at just ranking things on Google, getting traffic to their blog, making money through ads or affiliate, or if they're doing like a social play, bringing people to maybe an affiliate buyer's guide to buy things. Obviously, with a team or a business and a brand, I guess what were your objectives and how did you achieve them there? Because I'm assuming, yes, website traffic might be a goal, but maybe it's more about branding there than it is about bringing traffic to make sales as such.
Well, I was looking at myself as kind of a 1099 person, because my my wedding photography was really the only thing that I was doing completely freelance. That was my company. For the real estate, I did a little bit of freelance, but it was mostly 1099 work for other photographers. And I was doing all of the web design, graphic design, content management, all that. Again, 1099 for the rugby team, 1099 for the data science company, things like that. And so I saw myself as this 1099 kind of person. And so all of my branding and all of that really went into my wedding photography business, which was a lot of nights and weekends. And so it just didn't really suit me to keep doing that. And especially after I got my degree, I felt like I can go and command a higher income in the marketplace as far as having a job. Didn't want a job because I've got six kids and I'm in my 40s. It's just not I always just kind of wanted to work part-time. I already had a part-time gig with the homemaking and the family stuff. And so for me, just having to get out there and figure out like, where am I going to spend my time that I'm going to get the biggest ROI on that time? And for me, there are certain people that will go start a tech company or something like that, and they've got some expertise. I personally can't do that unless I had technicians that I could hire and all that, and building a business. So I really wanted to be a solo freelancer, 1099 style, but also making as much money as I possibly could. And when I looked at the most wealthy people who were kind of one man names, you know, one man show, it was business owners, entrepreneurs, and also real estate investors. And so I put together those ideas of a real estate business with the real estate investor, because if you're going to have a business, it should be a real estate business. And that's kind of what I was thinking. And because of my background, and I love architecture, I love buildings and all of that, it was a really natural fit for me, because I actually like real estate. Some people just do it because it makes a lot of money, but I really just like being in the space.
Yeah, fair enough. Before I jump down the real estate road, I think the listeners might find that quite interesting as a way of diversification as well. Regarding the content marketing side of that job with the different teams and business and things. What was one of those goals, like things like growing engagement on social media or anything like that? You mentioned you like systems. Did you have any systems or anything in place that you liked, I guess, to use or you found helpful in terms of trying to grow that engagement?
Well, when I started out, I think I fell into the DIY trap that everybody falls into. I was like, I'm trying to get in there and learn HTML and hand code websites. And then I discovered WordPress and plugins. And even since then, you know, Wix and even Google Sites. If you've got some design background, some visual design background, you can really get efficient with the if you know how to use the front end tools and create that front end product. The back end, I didn't really care about. I don't want to be an HTML coder. I wanted to get out there and I just wanted to get work done. And so spending a lot of time with creating the website and that type of stuff was really just a distraction from going out and making money, unless I was going to be a web designer for somebody else and help them make their entrepreneur websites. When I'm trying to make money off of my website, I needed to spend as much time making money and as least time working on the technical solutions as possible. So my husband and IT guy, I remember one day I was having trouble when I was trying to figure out, I think Dreamweaver. I'm like, I do Photoshop, I do Illustrator, I can totally do Dreamweaver. And I was just struggling getting through the HTML part of it. And I told him I needed help. And he said, this is your business. It's not my business. I already have a job. I said, no, I am a photographer. I am a graphic designer. You are an IT guy. I need an IT guy. And he just sat there and he looked at me for a second and he said, all right, scoot over. It was just like Saturday Night Live, move. And he sat down and he really handled my IT after that, because he recognized that we should specialize in what we're good at. And so for me, it was a lot of SEO. It was a lot of trying to figure out what the Google algorithms are. Now with social media, it's the same, the Facebook algorithms, the YouTube algorithms, figuring out how to drive traffic in there. Back then, Facebook was pretty new. When I first started getting into photography, my husband would come in and he'd see me on Facebook and he would think that I was just wasting time. I say, no, I'm working. I work on Facebook. He's like, right, you're working. Because I recognized Facebook pages, put my business on there, and then I had to go interact with people to drive them to my personal page and my business page. So then they could go to my website and figure out they wanted me to take pictures. And then realizing I didn't want to do family photography, and I had to move over to, okay, how do I reach the brides? How do I reach the real estate agents, people like this, and always revising what that niche was going to be and who that ideal client in that niche was going to be. So it was a ton of figuring out how to write to my ideal client. And the other person I wrote to was Google. Like, what does Google want to see on here? Yeah. Real plain English, lots of city names, what do I want to Google for? And all my blog posts and all of my social media posts were written with basically keyword stuffing, but in real English. I'm a good writer, and so that was a really good fit for me, because I can come up with, I can write really fast. And so I was able to just really focus on how to spend the least amount of time on stuff that I'm not good at, that I don't like, and the most amount of time driving traffic into the revenue center of my business, which was, at that point, it was booking gigs, either a client like the rugby team who wanted me to do their online marketing, or, a specific bride or real estate agent.
Gotcha. So you mentioned about writing to, I guess, your customer avatar, essentially. So how did you figure that part out? Like, who your avatar was? Was there a process that you went through to figure that out?
Yeah, and it's kind of funny, because I've been doing this real estate thing now for, I guess, 4 years, and I'm just redoing my avatar again, because I've really struggled to find that person in this new industry. I knew that it was important, and I knew that it was the lifeblood of my business prior. And so as I'm going through this process right now, I haven't been attending any conferences or going to any meetups, because I really need to figure out why I struggle to raise enough capital to do I do huge deals, and it needs a lot of money. And so figuring out how to raise that much capital has been a real challenge. Who I'm talking to. So I'm going through the process again, and I realized I'll draw a parallel to, like, say my ideal bride. People talk about your avatar. You should know where they buy their coffee. You should know how old they are, what color hair they, what kind of makeup store they're shopping at, what kind of clothes, what kind of car they drive. And we get caught up in those things a little too quickly. I think that comes farther down the avatar design pipeline. What I started out with on the bride, and I did this on accident, and I realized it really worked well, and I'm trying to do now with my ideal capital or money partner avatar, it's not so much about what coffee they're drinking. It's more about what are our interactions going to look like. And when I figure out the type of person that I want to spend time with in my business, then I can sit and think more about like, what are they driving? You know, what are their hobbies, things like that. But if you start there, which is what I was doing, because I was rebuilding my real estate avatar and I was spending too much time on what hobbies they were doing and all of that. And I realized I just was missing again and again and again. So recently I just kind of had this epiphany, like this is the same thing. Like, how do I want our relationship to look? What do I want our interactions to look like? Mm-hmm. So with the bride, I was looking for somebody who was easygoing, who maybe knew what she wanted, but she wasn't going to be a diva or a princess or my daddy's a lawyer if you don't give me what I want. I wanted her to be decisive because I wanted her to make decisions when she was on my website, reading my bio and looking at my pictures, that our personalities would really merge. And so I talked to her in a sarcastic, down to earth, you know, you don't really care about how I like to walk on the beach. You just want to know how I'm going to make you look while you walk on the beach. You know, that type of language. I had people hire me just based on my about me section alone. And that was actually pretty common. They'd see the pretty pictures. They'd go read about me. It wasn't about me. It was about what I was going to do for them, how I was going to make them look, how I was going to make them feel. And so once I figured out the type of bride and groom I wanted to interact with, then it became easy to kind of figure out like what their income level was, what type of professions they would do, because I was looking for a certain personality versus somebody who was at a certain place or spending a certain amount of money. And so I'm redoing that all now with my business. I want investors, again, who are decisive. I've had investors tell me before, they're like, just send me it, whatever it is, I'll invest in it, I trust you, which absolutely does not fit my avatar. It does for some people. But I don't want that kind of responsibility, and I don't want people to put their responsibility for due diligence off onto somebody else. That's not taking charge of your financial freedom and your financial future. So I want somebody who doesn't say, I'll just trust you, just send me what I'll invest in it. I want to put together a data room of information that they need in order to make a decision. And I'm happy to teach them what they're looking at, what are you reading, but put that together, walk them through the process of education, and then they can be decisive and make decisions. I'm also looking for somebody who doesn't necessarily want to do this as their own business or a new hobby. That's mostly who I have in my network right now, other investors who really want to get in there and be active, and how do I buy an apartment building, all that. But when you're raising capital, I really want to reach people who are more like the people in your network. So here's another thing is, like, I spend a lot of time at real estate conferences, real estate networking groups. I find a lot of partners there. I find a lot of vendors there. I find a lot of people who want to learn there, but I don't really find a lot of people who want to be limited partners there. So tapping into somebody else's network, figuring out what that avatar looks like. So for me, somebody who's decisive, somebody who's ambitious, somebody who has enough money that they can put into a deal without freaking out, because it's like keeping them up at night. They put every dime in it. The minimums are high. It's $50,000 per deal for these private placements. And so if somebody only has $50,000, I don't want that money. I want them to be able to put that 50 in, have an emergency fund on top of that, and maybe a little bit more dry powder that they either have or they can go make if they're a high income earner. They can go do another surgery, or they can go, you know, do another website or something, and be able to keep that money rolling in, and they just have more than they need. I want somebody who identifies with my values, living below their means. We're not motivated by private jets and things like that. We're motivated by freedom of time. So you go focus on what you do best in your technical niche. I'll focus on what I do best in my niche, which is finding great real estate deals for people to invest in, and then tapping into different networks where we can reach out to those people. I'm not going to find those people at a real estate conference. I'm just really not. And so redesigning what that avatar looks like. I still don't know like where they shop, what they drive, or all of that, but I definitely know the type of person I want to be interacting with, and I'll start there. And as that gets fleshed out by meeting people, I kind of figure out, oh, this person has a great personality, is the kind of person I want to look at. And I just start finding patterns in that, where they spend their time, how they shop, you know, what they do for a living.
No, I'm so glad we touched on that custom avatar stuff, because I guess it's somewhat known in, I guess, in general marketing that you should be talking to a certain persona, essentially. And from what you said, I need to redo my about pages as well. So I'm going to do that at some point. And instead of it being more about me and this, make it more about them. And I really like that. And I think, I guess for as an example, maybe in the affiliate space, if you're maybe doing a website on weight loss, it might be talking to someone then who has tried losing weight, has been sold many different diets, has tried many different things, and has failed multiple times, and maybe they're fed up, and that's the kind of person you're talking to, and maybe then, maybe that helps then the language of what you're writing to direct to that kind of person as well, instead of just a generic kind of weight loss website. Yeah,
it definitely helps to know what everybody's avatar is, because you're looking, if you're looking for that, mm-hmm. then you're just one more person in a sea of people trying to reach. And I'll give you an example from a friend of mine who sells essential oils. And I said, it's very awkward when I'm talking about health and fitness, when somebody will say, well, have you tried essential oils for it yet? Because I know a lot of people who sell essential oils. And I don't ever know what to say. Like, I got that under control. Thanks. But good luck on your business. It's really tough. And he said, we're not looking for people like you. We are not looking for somebody who's really into health and fitness and already has basically their dealer. We're also not looking for people who are completely skeptical, who are like, essential oils are just, that's just woo woo. He said, we're looking for people who are just starting on their journey down the path of alternative health. And when they're starting to look around for the first time and thinking, okay, maybe I need to do something different. That's the moment that that's their ideal client. And I thought, oh, that's really brilliant, because he didn't talk about where she shopped or who she hangs out with or what her hobbies are. He was talking about like where she is on that journey. And so that really helped me kind of realize that I'm not looking for the avatar that everybody else is looking for. I got to find the niche person so that I'm not just another voice in the sea. And so, for example, doctors, there are a lot of people out there who are trying to find doctors opportunities to invest in passive businesses, passive real estate. I don't know anything about medicine. I really don't care. I don't want to go to a medical conference and talk about surgeries. And so where do I want to spend time? Most of my former photographer friends, graphic designer friends, they don't have any money. It's a hustle type of a business, and you're struggling to make ends meet type of a business. So I thought to myself, okay, where are people like my photographer friends who are not maybe data scientists going to talk about like software development? I don't want to talk about that either, right? And I realized like the people that I really resonate with are the digital marketers, because that's my background. That's my former business. But at the same time, most of people running agencies is still just struggling to make ends meet. Who's making a lot of money in this space? Who has extra money that they don't know what to do with? And so for me, it was like, all right, I want digital marketers who make a lot of money and they're trying to figure out what to do with it, because they already have a specialty, an area of expertise. They already have a job. They don't want another job. And so for me, it was like people who are doing like online stores, drop shipping, Amazon, Walmart stores, people who are doing high-end websites where they're doing basically digital real estate, digital marketing. Those are the people that I realized, because not only do we have something in common, I actually want to talk to them because we have a common background, but they're also very successful in their field, and they don't really have time to shift businesses because what they're doing is really working. And so when I figured that out, I feel like, that's finally somebody that I can spend time with, and I don't have to go to a medical conference and pretend I like talking about dentistry.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few of those people listening here, digital marketers that might have some money to look to invest. And that's kind of why I wanted to bring you on as well and talk about, I guess, diversification, because obviously it's probably the most used word within the niche website space with Google updates, tanking sites, and people, you know, wondering if they should do 1, 2, 3 sites, if they should try to de-risk their business through various other methods. But obviously one option for diversification is having, I guess, income streams outside of this digital real estate, as you mentioned. Now, obviously, I guess one stat, I don't know how true it is, that often gets thrown around is the richest people in the world have on average, 7 income streams or something like 7 different income streams. So if you have your digital real estate, then that's, maybe you have a few different ones there, but maybe you can diversify further. So I guess real estate is a popular way of doing that, but I wanted to know, as an absolute newbie to real estate investing or anything, why real estate over, I don't know, anything else in terms of, I guess, investment? Because even with niche websites, you've got a lower upfront capital to get in. It's very cheap. You've got very high upside in terms of scalability. You've also got a very high, exit on the other end too. If you're making X amount of profit, you're getting 30 to 40X on your sale on top of that. So why real estate when you've got such a big upfront cost and maybe lower cash flow coming from
it? I would say that what I do, the mindset shift that I had to have is before when I was 1099 or doing a real, sorry, a website, and somebody would pay me and I would go and I would deposit that in the bank. And then I would just keep, you know, rinse and repeat. So the holy grail of a business is passive income. And there's nothing that does that better than real estate, but it is like a snowball. It's not a get rich quick, but it's definitely a get rich ever, right? If you just get in it and you just keep playing in the space, no matter if there's a recession or a dip or anything like that, it just will keep chugging along and will keep reaping you benefits that you never really realized were possible in a very passive way. And so that's, I think, for a lot of people, the number one. That was what attracted me to it. It was high income, but could be very passive. So I don't flip houses. I don't do wholesaling where I just find cheap things and sell them to flippers. I don't do things like that. I basically, because my husband still has a W-2, I can play the long game. I don't need the cash flow. And so I can always be deferring that gratification. And so that's what people who can keep the lights on can do with real estate. And then it becomes very, very passive. The other thing that no other business will give you is the tax benefits. So as business owners, you understand that if you're a W-2 guy, you get what, a couple of write-offs. If you're a business owner, you get like something like 150 different write-offs that you can take in your business. But one thing that only real estate people can take in a large degree is that depreciation. You can depreciate your equipment, your computer, maybe your home office or things like that. But I get to depreciate massive buildings. So I'll give you one example. I'm a full-time real estate professional. So I can take more depreciation than somebody who has some other kind of income. You can take a lot, but I get to take even more. And because my husband's W-2 and he gets really crap write-offs, I'm able to take all that depreciation as a real estate professional and offset his active income. So his W-2 income, taxable income, looks terrible on paper. Yeah. I've lowered it dramatically. And so about 2 years ago, we got a tax return that was so huge, so unexpectedly huge, that we went and took it and put a down payment on a new house. Like, I got a free house from Uncle Sam. And that's, you know, that's what I'm living in right now. So we rented it out for a little while, decided we wanted to be more nomadic, we want to travel more, kind of pre-planning for that more passive income lifestyle. So we actually rented out our big house and moved into this little rental of ours, brand new. I love it. I mean, my life is totally different. My lifestyle is totally different because I don't have a yard anymore. The house is small. It takes 10 minutes to clean. And we can leave and go travel and do nomad things. And it's very rentable. Our big house is a lot harder to rent out because it's just not your standard 3-2 type of thing. And so for us, like planning for that passive income and those tax benefits, nothing else does it like real estate. The other thing is leverage. If you guys want to go buy some new equipment for your business, there are very few things that you can get loans on for your business. But what if you wanted to go invest in something and you want to buy stocks, bonds, treasuries, things like that? Nobody's going to loan you money to go do that. Now, you can do some risky stuff, you know, on margins and things like that. Takes an expert.
You get margin called now.
You can really lose your shirt there. But for me, I can go and I can leverage an asset 65 to maybe 85%, depending on the asset itself and what the market is doing. There's nothing else that you can invest in where you can take out that kind of leverage. And your cash on cash return goes way up because you don't have that much cash into it. The other thing is when I put people or renters into my real estate, whether it's a multifamily or it's commercial and I've got a business tenant in there, guess who's paying my mortgage? Not me. So I basically have principal pay down, tax savings, a very passive income stream. It takes a while to get it to that point, but that's definitely where we're all aiming, that in leverage that you just don't get with any other kind of business or any other kind of asset.
Damn, okay. So maybe let's break this down a little bit for people like me who maybe some of these terms are like, what the hell do some of these mean? And maybe for some of the listeners as well. So depreciation, write-offs on the house, and then leverage with the house. And I think another important point before we jump into those is being self-employed, for example, if you own your own niche websites, you're making money through whatever, it's very hard to get loans, mortgages, whatever else, because I guess the government doesn't really like you because you don't have a job. Like, that's something that we worried about moving back to USA, even just renting a house because we didn't have a contract. Like, we got, I don't know if we got lucky or not, but we managed to find a house relatively easily just by showing bank statements. But I mean, if we're going to go a step further and eventually buy, then things will start getting more difficult. So maybe let's start with depreciation and leveraging.
Well, I think what you bring up is a good point. Something else I discovered about my avatar as I was going through, I really like people who love learning. They love drinking from a fire hose. They love doing research, going down a rabbit hole, but then they're right back to their area of expertise. And so they're going to get in, they're going to figure it out, they're going to get it done. And so I think this is great because I like drinking from a fire hose, and sometimes that's what I give other people. So I appreciate you slowing me down, but at the same time, it's like people who love doing it that way, those are the kind of people that I like spending time with and I want to work with. So that was another thing I had to realize about my avatar. So depreciation, you can't depreciate land. Land goes up in value, but you can depreciate everything that's built on the land. So it'd be the same as you depreciating your computer, right? Or let's say you're driving a car for your business, and you basically get to write that off. And so you take the life of that piece of equipment, and they all have different tables how you do that. With real estate, it's 30 years. And so you basically break the value of that down into 30 pieces, and you take that each year. Well, in 2017, the tax structure was redone a little bit so that we could take what's called accelerated depreciation. So you can take most of it in year one and year two, because things like a roof or a concrete foundation are going to depreciate a lot over a lot more years, and something like my carpet might be only 2 years. And so, well, they'll go in and they'll take everything that depreciates faster, that wears out faster, and you can take all of that depreciation upfront year one, sometimes year two. Now those are changing, that's being stepped down. And so this is the last year you basically get 100% depreciation on the front end like that. And so a lot of people are looking to throw some cash into real estate this year before those laws change, if they understand how that works. And people are finding that it's more difficult to raise money right now because the stock market is down. Nobody wants to bake in those losses by pulling out and moving into another asset class. But I do see a lot of people wanting to take advantage of that accelerated depreciation, which is how we basically got a free house, accelerated depreciation on our rentals and some of our commercial properties. So that's the depreciation aspect. Somebody may renew this accelerated depreciation thing. So far, doesn't look like it. So the next couple of years as it's stepping down is really when it's going to be the most powerful, before it goes back to just straight line where it's 1/30th every year for 30 years. Now you do have to recapture that when you sell it. And so what I like to do when I sell an asset is to take that capital gain that I make off of that and then go put it into another project that has depreciation, because then I can just keep kicking the ball down the field.
Does that, I think it was on the Graham Stephan show on YouTube. Is it that if you sell a house and the capital gains, if you roll that over into another house and you don't pay tax at all on it?
There are a lot of details and rules on how to do it, and it depends on the structure that you're going to take. So there's something called a 1031 exchange where if you, let's say you own a house in an LLC or in your personal name, you have to go buy into the next deal in that same entity, that same LLC or that same personal name. And so for me, because I have partnerships and we create a new LLC for every single property, it's a lot more difficult to do. And there are ways you can get around it. But basically you sell it, and as long as it's in that same entity and you take not only your gain, but the original basis as well, and go put it into the next one, then you can keep pushing those taxes down the road. And the people who love doing that are the people who have enough cash flow coming off of their portfolio that they don't actually need the gains. They're going to take the gains and go reinvest them and then live off of the cash flow. And that does take time to set up. That's what we're working on over the next 1 to 2 years, getting enough cash flow so that we can just live off the distributions and just keep reinvesting, and again kicking the ball down the field where you can defer taxes. We also have opportunity zones in real estate, which are also being phased out. That was part of the same 2017 tax package, where if I hold an asset for 10 years, I pay zero capital gains, zero, as long as it's in this geographic location and I hold it for at least 10 years. But they have incentives if you hold it for 5 years and 7 years where it's stepped down. But if you hold it in an opportunity zone for 10 years, you pay no capital gains. Here's another example. We have that big house that we rented out. If you live in your house for 2 of the previous 5 years, then when you sell it, you have up to $500,000. If you're married, zero capital gains, $500,000 tax free. And so it gives you 3 years after you move out of your primary residence to rent it out, live on some cash flow, and wait for it to appreciate another 3 years beyond when you moved out of it. And then you sell it. It's $250 for an individual, $500, you know, because you get both. and then you walk away with $250,000 yeah. because you let it appreciate. Plus, you got cash flow during that time. So these are the kind of tax incentives that we get because the government doesn't want to privatize, to make public housing. They want to keep housing privatized. They want to incentivize us to provide housing and rentals because they don't want to have to deal with socialized housing and they don't want to have to deal with the project and all that. So they give us a lot of incentives to provide housing for the public at large. The other thing is a lot of the lawmakers who made these tax incentives in order to get us to participate in certain businesses and certain activities, it's a manipulation. They know what that tax law is. And so a lot of the lawmakers are now heavily invested in this as well. And so they're going to keep those protections. They're going to keep babysitting it. They're going to keep making sure, because that's where all their stuff is as well. And so I just look at what people who are in charge, rich people and powerful people, what are they doing? Are they hustling around at a 9-to-5? Not usually. They're investing in things that are tax advantaged. And they're just watching what's going on, and I just copy what they do. Another example is the Federal Reserve. If inflation is high, let's say your house goes up in value $100,000. Your mortgage didn't go up. You have a 30-year mortgage on that, or if it's commercial, maybe 10 years. Commercial loans tend to be shorter. But that mortgage doesn't change, even though your equity is way up with inflation. So basically what you're doing is you're saying, hey, my purchasing power with my dollar went down, but I've got cheap debt back in the day. And now I've got all this appreciation, all of this equity, rents have gone up, but my mortgage hasn't changed. And that's the leverage that we're talking about. So if the Fed is basically letting inflation run away for a little while before they start raising rates to calm it down, it looks like they're doing it for us. We just don't want to raise rates too fast because you won't be able to get a mortgage. They're not doing it for us. Yeah. They're doing it so that the national debt can be inflated down just the same way that I benefit on real estate. They can take out lots and lots of debt and they just inflate their way out of it. Because after 20, 30 years, when you look at the value of future dollars, what they ended up paying off, sometimes you can even make money on debt because of inflation inflating your way out of debt. So when I'm watching powerful people in the Fed and politicians do this on purpose, why wouldn't I want to do the same thing? I'm going to get me some cheap debt and then wait for inflation to basically make it a profit center down the road.
Yeah, that's why people often say if you have, say, you're financed something for 10, 20 years, don't pay it off early. Just kind of keep running it because obviously inflation will eat away at that debt.
And there are some risk management things that change in there. So we don't want to have, obviously if you have 100% leverage, you're going to have massive cash flow, right? But there's a risk there. You don't ever want to go into something where you might get it taken away from you. And so if you're going to talk about risk management, it certainly goes counter to the math and to the benefits. But with risk management, I just make sure we just do the simple things like we have an emergency fund for each property. So if something big goes out, I also make sure that the numbers work. If something big goes out. So for example, people will get a rental house and it'll have a $1,200 mortgage, but they're renting it out for $1,600. They go, I'm cash flowing $400 a month on this. Thinking, well, that's not really the only thing you have to pay for on a house. If you're only just clearing above your mortgage, and it's usually a negative cash flow deal, looks cash flow positive in the short term. And a lot of people just don't know how to run their numbers and they just don't understand that this is how it works, which is why I don't invest in oil and gas and I don't invest in stocks. I buy stuff and I let other people run it because I don't want to learn about oil and gas and I don't want to learn about how crypto works. I just want to give somebody else my money and let them go because they love it. They eat it for breakfast. For me, that's how real estate is. It's like people will get a couple of rentals and they think they're doing well. But then 2008 or the recession we're looking at right now happens. Suddenly they really haven't put any money aside for a vacancy. What if people move out and it's vacant for a couple of months? If you can't pay that mortgage, that is the fastest way to lose your investment. So you do have to plan ahead. You can't over leverage, keep your payments low, have an emergency fund for when the new roof needs to go on. That new roof is basically amortized into your payment. Even though a $20,000 roof is 5 or 10 years down the road, you have to back amortize that across the life of holding that investment. Suddenly a $1,200 a month mortgage and a $1,600 a month rent looks like a pretty bad negative deal when every couple of years you have to replace a water heater or a roof or you need a major repair. So most people just don't know how to run their numbers and they get themselves into trouble. So there are some great ways to make money off of this and in very passive ways. But you need to make sure either you or the person that you're giving your money to has a backup plan, because that is part of risk management with any kind of business.
Yeah. How big of an emergency fund would you need then for, I guess it depends on the size and the price of the rental property, but I guess in general, maybe just like a percentage rule.
Typically, like for like residential properties, people will say maybe 3 to 6 months of at least the mortgage. That would be the minimum. I don't do that per property, because once your portfolio starts to get larger and larger and larger, you're less likely to have the whole thing go out at once. And so I will maybe start out with 6 months for my first one, my first couple per property, and then I start to combine that more into a pool. When you get into commercial stuff, we usually like at least $1,000 per unit, basically set aside per year so that we can get stuff done. So if it's a 50-unit building, it's $50,000 a year. In a commercial, that doesn't really pay for very much. A parking lot's $100,000, you know, re-roofing the whole thing is, you know, $400,000. And so you're setting that aside year after year after year to save up for one. So it was at least $1,000 per unit. And then as you start getting into larger and larger properties, we'd like to keep about 10% of our total net worth liquid. And that would be more of a personal thing. The property has its own liquidity fund, and then you also have your own, because there are things called capital calls. If your business is not doing well, the partners have to pony up, and so you need to make sure you're maintaining some of your liquidity as well. And I don't keep it as cash in the bank. I have other things that I do with it to keep it liquid, because real estate's not liquid. Once crypto technology, blockchain technology is able to tokenize real estate, it will become a lot more liquid because we can buy and sell tokens.
Oh yeah. Well, have you seen? Is it lofty.ai?
Yeah, Lofty, yeah. Red Swan. I think also there's a new one called S Token. And so it's coming. It's really coming. S Token is supposed to be released by the end of the year, and they'll have both a primary and a secondary market for tokenizing real estate. So it will eventually become more liquid if you're in a tokenized transaction. But right now, it's really not liquid. Yeah. Some companies, you can buy a token just in their properties, and so that might be a liquid investment. But there are companies like S Token who are trying to make that across the entire spectrum, so the entire industry is more liquid. So I don't keep my liquidity in real estate. That's why my net worth is a lot higher than my liquidity, because my net worth is in equity and properties and things like that. But liquidity, I keep it in a life insurance policy. It's called Infinite Banking. Basically you take out a cash value life insurance policy. Don't do this with your regular agent. It has to be someone who knows how to do this and can design it properly. But if you get like an infinite banking, or be your own bank, or your family bank, there are lots of things that people call it. But I just buy, it's basically an overfunded life insurance policy where I stuff a lot of cash into it. And so there's usually a minimum we need to put in each year. So make sure the minimum is something you can afford if you have some extra cash kicking around. I put it in the policy first, I let it season for a couple of years, and then I can come back in and I can loan that back out of my policy. And basically the appreciation, or the interest rate that I'm getting on the policy, which is kind of low, like 3%, 3.5%, something like that.
Yeah, it's more than the banks will give you anyway.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's way higher than what you're getting cash in the bank, which is why I don't keep cash in the bank. I keep like ready cash in the bank, like maybe one month in the bank. And then I'll put like a year, 2 years into a life insurance policy. And then, like I said, it seasons for a couple of years, and then it will pay its own premium, because as you're getting a return on leaving your money in there, the premium is actually the same as your interest rate. So it's like a net zero. But then I can start borrowing my money back out. I'm borrowing it from the insurance company. Insurance companies, talk about real estate getting favors from lobbyists. Insurance companies are the oldest companies in the country. What they want, they get. That money is judgment proof. If I get sued, somebody slips and falls, they don't even look at that as something that they can get at. So it is part of my net worth, and it is part of my liquidity, but you can't get at it in a lawsuit. Unless, of course, I've done something criminally fraudulent, negligent, things like that. But just for your average Joe who's just trying to run a good business, it's judgment proof. So I keep a lot of liquidity in these policies. And every time I get the policy paid up, where I can't put any more money to it, I'll go buy a new one. And then another thing where I keep it is I will have at least one property in my portfolio that doesn't have a mortgage, is free and clear, but it has a HELOC on it. So basically it's a line of credit against the house, and it just sits there. It might be empty, right? Or maybe it's full because I took out 100 grand or 150 grand to go invest in something. But I'm basically borrowing against my house and it sits there liquid. And the reason I don't have a mortgage is because a HELOC as a second mortgage will sometimes get called, it'll get closed, it'll get reduced. It's just a lot more risky. So I usually will get a HELOC that I can use to pay off my mortgage. And then it just sits there empty as ready cash. And then I also, like I said, I'll keep a month in the bank. And then every year, every 2 years, if we're not trying to get a mortgage, because like you said, you touched on, mortgages can be hard to get. If you've got too many of them, you can't buy a car when you're trying to get a mortgage. You shouldn't apply for new credit cards. Like, don't do anything when you're trying to get a mortgage. And with us, we're always trying to get a mortgage, right? So when we're not trying to get a mortgage, we will go out and we will get lines of credit from various banks. And they can close them at any time they want. They can cap them, they can call them, but we just get them and we just leave them empty. $20,000 from this credit union, $30,000 from that credit union. And over a year, two, 3 years time, that's $100,000, $200,000 of just empty credit lines. And that does two things for us. One, it's at least a little bit of an emergency fund, 10% cheaper than a credit card, right? But we also get credit cards as well for liquidity.
Yeah.
You can't count those as liquidity to your lender, but it is still an emergency fund for you personally.
Yeah.
The other thing it does is when you have really high limits, but you don't use any of it, your credit is sky high. So if you want to get a mortgage, you better have a 750, 850 credit score. If you have any other issue, like you're self-employed or there's some reason you're not mortgage worthy, you add a bad credit score on top of that, you're dead in the water. So we really do focus a lot on keeping our credit scores very, very high, keeping us loan worthy, and keeping huge lines of credit that we don't touch unless it's an emergency. And that it's basically your utilization rate. If your utilization rate, let's say we have $100,000, but we've used zero, our utilization rate is zero. If we use $100,000 of it, it's 100%. Don't have it over 30% for personal lines of credit. Now, this is all changes with business lines of credit, right? I can max it out to 100%. It doesn't affect my business credit. Okay. So I will get business credit cards. Business lines of credit are harder to get, but if you've been around a while, go talk to your banker about getting yourself a business line of credit. Just don't touch it. It's a nice little liquid emergency fund that you can use if you need to. The other thing that we do is we don't get personal mortgages anymore. We get them to our LLC, a little bit more expensive, slightly higher interest rate. The other thing about commercial, I can have billions of dollars of commercial loans. Like nobody's cutting me off because of my income or anything like that. Commercial doesn't look at your personal finances. They just look at your credit score, which is another reason we like to keep it high. So we can actually help sign on other people's loans if they need somebody with experience, high net worth, high liquidity, and a great credit score. So we really watch that because then we can get into people's deals without really having to do anything because we just come out and help sign on the loan, basically guarantee the loan.
Yeah, it's such an interesting game to learn. Like all of it is just like, it's almost like you level up every time you have something new and you can kind of keep going. But I wanted to touch on, you mentioned, obviously you have the life insurance policy you borrow from, and as you mentioned, you can't get sued for that money. Then you have the HELOC that you borrow from as well. So what's the benefit of going to borrow that money back versus just having that cash ready to go? Because is that interest-free borrowing then, or is there something else to it?
There is an interest. The thing about the HELOC is you have to pay it back on their timetable. Like it's a monthly payment and it's 5% or 10% or whatever, and you got to pay that back. With a life insurance policy, it's unstructured. So I don't ever have to pay it back. I just take it out I may be making 3% on the the interest on my policy, and I may be paying 3% for the loan. And so it's a net wash. So it's as long as I know that the policy premium can be paid and I borrow out, and there are certain percentages your agent can help you through that. Like don't borrow more than this much, and then the next year you can borrow a little bit more. As the policy continues to grow. So you just know kind of where those limits are. I can take that out and I don't ever, ever, ever have to make a payment on it or pay it back. It's my own money, but I'm leaving my money with the insurance company. They're investing it on my behalf and then I borrow money from them. So it's not technically my money. It kind of is, you're getting technicalities there, but I'm able to use that as a source of liquidity. And we just put our emergency fund in there. We just throw it in there, make a payment to it every month. Just automatic from like our W-2 HR, just, sends money to our thing, and then automatic payments just go out to various places from there. So that's one of the things that we just stash money in. And if we have to pay taxes at the end of the year, or we have to, just have some expenses that come up, we can just pull it out of there. Other forms of liquidity are your typical things, like if you have business assets, you can count that as liquidity as long as they're sellable. You can count your brokerage account, you can count your cryptocurrency, you just have to keep it up fair market value. So as long as you keep some liquidity high, you can really weather a lot of storms. And when people say, oh, I lost everything in 2008, you'll hear that again and again. It'll make you scared of real estate. What they did is they didn't have an emergency fund. Their loans were maybe too high of leverage. Their payments were too high. And they say they lost everything because they couldn't get a renter and they couldn't keep paying the mortgage and they had a default. Most of the people who lost everything in 2001 just panic sold. They sold and upside down and they owed a lot of money on it. So don't ever panic sell, ever. No matter what you're in. It's just the same thing with running a business. If you wait to sell your business until it's not doing well or you're tired of it, you're not really going to get a very good offer. You want to sell it high. So making sure you have your intellectual property, your trademarks are taken care of, your books are really clean, you're getting an annual business evaluation, you're really building this business with the intent to sell it. You're going to sell it at its height and you're going to feel like you just sold your baby, right? Yeah. So it's the same thing. Like, don't panic sell. Don't sell when things are down. Don't sell when you're exhausted or burned out. You know, sell it high. And so I just saw a lot of people panic selling because, oh, values are going down. I better sell before I lose even more. And I'm like, you know, just wait. It'll come back. It took a long time to come back, but it'll come back.
Nice. Before I jump into, I guess, how people, I guess, like us in the space can kind of get started in real estate, I just wanted to touch on, as you're self-managing the properties versus having an agency do it. This is something, I guess, I've actually just comes to my mind a lot when I think about real estate. I'm like, well, I don't want to sit there having to answer calls or texts of someone saying, oh, you know, this is broken. Can you? I'll be like, nah, like, I don't want to have to deal with that. So I guess what's the advantage of going through, say, an agency? Because I'm assuming they would take a big enough cut where you would need to be making enough on the rent to cover the mortgage plus then the agency, then that becomes a little more difficult. So is that feasible for someone who maybe is getting in on one property, or do you have to self-manage that first one and kind of build your portfolio before getting an agency to kind of run it?
There's different schools of thought on this. And so we go over just some pros and some cons. For tax purposes, I self-manage my small local properties, you know, my duplex, my single families, things like that. I self-manage those. Because I am a real estate professional, I have to spend at least 750 hours a year working on real estate related activities. And I have to be significantly involved in the management of the source of my passive income. So if I have passive income, rent income is considered, for tax purposes, is considered passive. And then you have ordinary or active income, which is what you get from a job. If you loan someone money, you make money on interest, capital gains, that's all ordinary. Passive is either long-term capital gains or rent income, things like that. So if I want to use all that depreciation, I have to be actively involved in the management of my passive income, which means I self-manage my small local portfolio. There are a lot of IT tools that make that a lot easier. And we're talking about efficiencies earlier with not building your backend website. You don't have to know HTML. Yeah. I mean, it helps, right? But you shouldn't be spending a lot of time on things that you can pay somebody else for $50 or $100 an hour. Your activity should be the $1,000 or the $10,000 an hour jobs that you, or stuff you just cannot hire anyone to do. Like, you know, you're the CEO of your business, act like it, right? So for me, it's the same thing. I use those IT tools to make it more efficient, and it takes payments for me. They can set up automatic payments. There's a maintenance portal. They put that in there. The maintenance requests are automatically forwarded in my email to my handyman, and they schedule directly. Or I have like a list of places they could call if something goes wrong. Good example is Roto-Rooter for plumbing. You can get cheaper plumbers, right? But Roto-Rooter, my tenant can just go on their website and they can schedule it online. The plumber shows up. I don't even have to know about it. Plumber shows up. I mean, there'll be a maintenance ticket in there, but when he shows up, he calls me, he tells me what's wrong. I say, go ahead and fix it. And he charges my credit card. Now, could I get a cheaper plumber? Could I do it cheaper if I went and did it myself? Most definitely. But my time is more valuably spent by raising capital for larger deals, by vetting larger deals. I am not going over there and dealing with the plumber at my little rental. IT tools and those efficiencies make it so that I can self-manage in a way that I only have to go to my properties every couple months just to do my regular inspections They hide things from you. You know, there'll be a leak or something. They don't want you in there because they have too many pets that they haven't claimed, or they're smoking or cooking meth, and they know they're not supposed to. So they won't tell you about maintenance stuff if they feel like you're going to catch them doing something else. So I just make sure I get in there quarterly, maybe annually, depending on the property and the tenant.
Yeah.
So I just really focus on how to do that efficiently. For my commercial properties, I have so many units that the IRS would definitely justify me in hiring a property manager. And so what we do on that is, instead of doing property management, we focus on what's called asset management. And so I meet with my property managers once a week when we're under heavy construction. And then once it's stabilized and things are running more smoothly, we'll meet every 2 weeks or even once a month and just make sure everything's going well. We set up KPIs. So those are the key performance indicators of things that are really important, so we can see where things are breaking down. Like, why is our income going down? Oh, I see you have less showings on vacant units. And so we'll have like a whole list of things we're mapping out, and they just fill out the spreadsheet or they send us reports from their property management software, so we can keep an eye on those KPIs. And so if anything is breaking down, it'd be like, hey, you have too many open maintenance requests, things like that. So asset management is like property management, but without doing the day-to-day. And anybody running commercial real estate, you should find out who that asset manager is, how much experience they have, and do they live local to the property, like those types of things. The property manager is usually always going to be local, but sometimes the asset manager is not. It's not necessary, but it's just nice if somebody lives pretty close to it. So I asset manage my commercial stuff, and I property manage my small stuff. And once all of our income is passive income and we no longer need to offset active income, like no more W-2 income, I won't self-manage. The only reason I do that is to offset my husband's active income.
Gotcha. I've got a billion more questions, but we're going to run out of time for ask more questions. So I've got one more, and it's to do with how to start. Say, I get this is going to be a very general, broad question, because obviously it's going to depend on where you're living, et cetera, et cetera. So let's just say maybe someone's built their website, they sold it for 5 to 6 figures, they paid their tax, they want to invest another maybe 20K into another website. And they've maybe got like, I don't know, 10 to 40K left over. Is that enough to get into real estate? What is the minimum you need to get in? And then what would be, I guess, your general advice for someone looking to get in for the first time? Would it be going into, for example, you mentioned commercial real estate, there's obviously your local residential real estate, there's different kinds of houses, I guess, within residential real estate too. So, it's also the group deals you have as well. So there's multiple options. So is there maybe some piece of advice or some way you would recommend someone to start?
We have a couple of different options. I run a commercial real estate investing club. It's a free club. We meet once a week and we just look at deals. Do we want to invest in this deal together or not? If you've got some cash and you want to put it in and you don't meet that $50,000 minimum, we usually suggest that you'll come and joint venture with the club, because it's still fairly passive, but you're not technically a limited partner. Limited partner is a legal definition that the SEC regulates very tightly. And so if you want to be a joint venture partner, somewhat active, learn the ropes, we recommend you come and joint venture with us through our club. And the club structure, it's a legal structure. We could just go down a rabbit hole with that. But I think the point is that we meet weekly for free and we just look at deals. And we've got committees. Like I said, your specialty, we've got an underwriting committee. We have a legal review committee. I do the marketing and the education with my committee. We've got IT and admin who help out with like making sure that our Zoom room works and our Facebook thing is kept up. Admin would be like helping people out who are new in the club and be like, I don't know what I'm doing. And they just kind of walk through. So we all volunteer in the club, and they're not paid positions. And you'll come and you'll basically learn a lot, drink from a fire hose, and you can get involved in a commercial deal with a much lower barrier of entry. We've helped a couple of dozen people get into their first deal as a general partner, meaning like a managing, you know, you're not the managing partner, but you definitely are not a limited partner. You're helping manage the deal. And we have some ongoing things that people will volunteer for and say like, hey, I can look up this or I can keep an eye on that. So that's one way to do it. If you've got the $50,000 and some excess on top of that, and you really don't want to do any of this, you can come to the club, learn how to evaluate a deal, and then just go in as a limited partner. And then you don't have to have any ongoing thing. And once you learn how to vet deals and all that, you get quicker at it. And so those are basically two options. Depends on how much cash you have. Now, if you want to be a limited partner and you really don't want to have any ongoing management at all, there are crowd funds that you can go into. Our club doesn't look at crowd funds as an investment opportunity, but we will look at deals. Like, let's say you're looking at investing in a crowd fund because you just really want to be a limited partner and you don't want to get involved in the club, but you'll come to the club for networking and education and say, hey, I'm looking at doing this deal on Fundrise or, you know, one of those websites where you can put in $500 or $10,000 or something like that. And if you come to the club and learn how to recognize a good deal, you'll see it on our club, but you'll also see it on a platform, crowdfunding platform like Fundrise. And so a lot of people will get on Fundrise and they'll hear about it and they'll be like, oh, this is great. They'll go to put some money in it and they're looking at the pro forma that the operators have sent out and they're like, I don't even know what I'm looking at, right? So that's really where the club can help out, because we can just get you that minimum, you know, 5-10 hours of education so that you can go and make somewhat informed decisions. Even as a limited partner, you do need to vet the deals out.
Yeah, fair enough. Where can people find, I guess, the club and kind of follow what you're doing as well?
I am on, my website is highrise.group. So it's HIGHRISE.GROUP. And because y'all are website people, I know that, you know, .group is, there's no .com. And people will say, I'm highrisegroup.com, and it wasn't you. So it's highrise.group. If you go to /contact, has my phone number on there, my email, it has all links to my socials. I'm Emma Powell 28 on Facebook and LinkedIn, and on Instagram I'm Passive Income Adventures. And that's more of a lifestyle, like fun stuff that we do because we are pursuing passive income and we take a lot of time off and we go on a lot of vacations and we have extra, a little bit of extra cash to burn on certain things. So that's where you can find me on social. And also if you go to highrise.group/podcast, I list everything that I've ever interviewed on, and if you want to do a binge listen, all my stuff is on there. So I'm trying to make it really easy to get a hold of me. I also have a calendar link on that contact page. So if you want to book a 30-minute call, it's free. You can do it as often as you want. I would say interviewing on podcasts or things like that, and those 30-minute calls are the favorite thing that I do in my business. So just reach out if you have some specific questions. I would love to talk to you. And I don't make any money off of the club. I'm not going to try and sell you anything. It's just I have to invest my money in deals, and the club makes it so that I have like a workout buddies to look at stuff together.
Yeah.
And I do really just enjoy helping people get into this. It's like a passion project of mine. And so I would love to just book a call and just chat about what your goals are and kind of help you figure out what direction you want to go.
Nice, perfect. I'll get that linked up in the description. You can add this podcast when it's out to your podcast page too as well. So thank you for coming on, Emma. I really appreciate it. Hopefully the listeners got something out of that.
Yeah,
as well.
Like I said, if this was a lot of information, we threw a lot out there. If this is your jam, reach out, join the club. Let's go do some deals. Very limited way. But if you are totally confused, we're actually doing a beginner series. It's a 4-week series where we just walk through it specifically for beginners, less fire hose, more for people who would prefer to just be limited partners. We're doing that every Thursday in July, and we'll probably do it again every Thursday in September. Nice. And again, it's free. It's just to help people figure this out. And if people want to invest as a limited partner, I love that because it's you're only limited. But the size of deal you can do is only limited by how much cash you can raise. If you can raise more cash, you can do bigger, better deals. And the bigger deals you get, the better deals come along because people know that you are serious. They know you're a closer and they start sending you stuff before anybody else sees it. And so you just have access to better stuff. So the more money you can raise, the more deals you can do. So I do like working with people, whether they want to get in and manage the deal because they love all of this rabbit hole stuff, or if they just prefer to be limited partners. Again, the more money we can raise, the better stuff we can do, the better deals we can send to people.
Perfect. Well, thanks for coming on, Emma.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
It's really good to reconnect, and you asked some really good questions. We really got deep on some of this stuff.
Yeah, even as a real estate newbie,
yeah.
Hopefully it was easy enough to... Perfect.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.